I love the idea of revisiting old songs and having fun with them, so thanks for doing that. Do you guys know that Revisited is actually a series that came from Trevor? Yeah, that's why he likes it so much. He's sitting in my office one day and he says, have you ever thought about like revisiting stuff you guys have talked about? We're always like, oh no, we can't do that. That'd be wrong, right? And he's like, you realize that you think about these messages for months at a time, and then you compress it into 30 minutes, and you think that we've thought about it enough in those 30 minutes to match your months of thinking. You know, you could take another swing at that. So if you don't like this message, talk to Trevor. If you like the message, you can talk to me. That's fine. Okay, today I did a message. I can show you a body of messages. This is kind of in a step to the side. Those messages got me thinking about something quite a bit. And I want to start by asking you guys kind of a weird question. Where have you failed in your life? Just take a second with that one. We look back through our lives, there's always these moments where we're going, oh, yeah, that didn't go well, or, you know, that kind of didn't work out the way I planned. During the mental health series, we had a series we just finished called Loving Your Neighbor with Mental Health. And I got an email during that series from a gentleman, and he agreed to let me share his story. His story starts in the 90s with, you know, a really good paying job, a huge salary, a marriage, kids. And his job kind of was the kind of job that he was doing really well. And then he moved into a consulting role to do this kind of big project. And that's when things started to get a little bit, you know, the speed wobble. He's like, man, they worked us hard. We had to deliver a lot. You could feel it was weighing on the team, him and his colleagues. And he said, during that time, I realized, I think I struggled. Depression. It wasn't major yet. I could still kind of will myself to go to work every day, but it just, the pressure and the travel and the deadlines, he's like, it just. And by the end, when the project ended, he said, they let me go. Here's a guy who's, you know, used to a six-figure salary. His family's used to a six-figure salary. Suddenly he's unemployed. He said he kind of made the best of it. He went back to school and took some things that he really wanted to do. He'd always wanted to study. And it was kind of a really interesting time because, you know, it wasn't about making money. It was about doing these beautiful things. But, man, the people in his life not having that salary, they weren't loving that. He said things were getting kind of worse and worse until one day he opened up an email that probably wasn't meant for him. And he found out that his wife was cheating on him. If you struggle with mental health issues, losing your job, finding out your spouse is cheating on you, these are not easy things for people who have healthy mental health. But for someone who's struggling, man, this took him out. It was years later, after the divorce had been finalized, he had nothing. His home-based business had not worked out. He couldn't hold down a job. He was just flat broke. I think when he told me the story, the moment that just hit me so hard is, he said, I was so poor, I couldn't pay my power bill. And on the day my kids came to stay with me for the 2 weeks that I got them, that's the day NMAX shut my power off. He's like, I tried to spin it. I tried to do everything I could. I was like, hey, kids, it's just a power outage. It's no big deal. They'll get the lights back on soon. We'll just use candles. It'd be like a picnic. But his kids were old enough to look outside the window and see all the neighbors' lights on and realize that this was not a power outage. I don't think I'm putting words in his mouth when I say, in his mind, he had failed. He'd failed to provide for his family. His marriage had failed. And now kind of the last kick in the balls, it was, I couldn't even have the lights on to have a great time with my kids. When I heard his story, my heart just went out to him. Because the reality is we've all failed, right? It might have been big, it might have been little. It might have been something that in your mind this is a failure, but everyone else can look at it and not a big deal. I was looking through my life. I'm divorced. That's definitely not in the winning camp, is it? I was in university. I was in engineering. I was most of my undergrad was in engineering. I had one class that was 8 o'clock in the morning. I didn't go. I remember showing up at the midterm and looking at the question in the midterm, and I didn't even understand some of the words they were using, never mind figuring out how to solve that question. How do you think I did on that one? I actually have, on my transcript, I have an F, or at least I had an F until I retook the course. I failed at that course. I failed to finish my engineering degree. I switched religious studies. I failed to do my PhD. And then just for another kick in the balls, and this one maybe won't resonate with you, but the other day, when I was younger, I did an half Ironman triathlon. I did it in 5 hours and 50 minutes, and I was like, yes. I just got a text from my friend the other day. She did it under 5 hours and 20 minutes. It's like, yeah. I think I'm too old and out of shape to get back into this, but I'm telling you, that failure felt a little bit like, oof. But we've all failed, haven't we? And you look back through your life, there's these moments, you know, when you're kind of up in the middle of the night and can't sleep, and your brain starts to bring up all the things you failed at. And sometimes, it's not I failed at, it's I'm failing at. I'm a crappy friend. I'm a selfish partner. I'm a lazy colleague. We have these moments, and it's even wider than that. As I'm looking at this thing, there's this other side that says, it's not even that I failed in my past, that's bad. It's not even that I'm currently failing, which is also bad. It's also that the people who came before me failed. Please don't raise your hands. But has anyone had family who you're just like, I'm dealing with your shit still because you guys screwed this up? Right? I live on the wrong side of tracks. I didn't get the education I wanted. I didn't have the opportunities I was hoping for. I didn't even have the kind of the nurturing system that would help me develop into my full potential of who I could be. So I'm not even failing. It's you who failed, and I'm dealing with it. Failure is all over the place. And today I don't want to just make you feel down. Well, I'll take it to a nicer direction. Don't worry. But I need you to feel this before we kind of move on. That feeling of, yeah, man, I did screw some stuff up. I am screwing some stuff up. And the interesting thing that I want to talk about is not just I screwed something up and that's just an absolute statement, but what does that mean, or what do we think that means about us that we screwed up? I'm divorced. Does that mean I can never be a good partner again? Does that mean I can never have love again? You fail at a business, does that mean you should never try again? You're always in the dumpster, you're always having to live out that failure? So it's not so much the failure, but what the failure means and how we see our worth. Because often when we're unhealthy, failure, or our sense of failure, or our perception of failure, has this ability to make us feel like, I have no value in the world anymore. I have no worth. And that's what I want to talk about today. What is it that our failure is making us feel about us? And I'm going to do it in the weirdest way possible, because that's how I roll. But it comes from the Bible. So when I was young, we had this whole thing where they wanted us to read the Bible. I think what they wanted us to do was learn from the Bible, but what they said was read the Bible. So basically, you just power read. And to read the Bible, like that sucker's big, right? Does anyone have a Bible? No, we don't really. We keep it all online. Those suckers are big. You have to read for like a half an hour to an hour every day of some really boring stuff. So as a 12-year-old, how much do you think I did? And this was old school. So the old school way was start in Genesis, so the very beginning of the Bible, the oldest stories we have. Not the most current, not using current language, not using current culture, but the oldest stuff. And then start reading until you just give up. It's kind of like, how far did you get? I got 2 chapters in. Next person's like, I got 2 books. We're all like, whoa. Now you have to understand there's like 66 books. So 2 books, you hardly got off the starting line, right? So some smart person said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to add a little of the newer part of the Bible with the older part of the Bible. Because the older part's kind of hard, and the newer part might be a little easy. It's kind of like having a broccoli, you put cheese on it, right? To get the broccoli down. That was the thinking. So the newer part of the Bible starts in a book called Matthew. And this is how it starts. Can you throw it up for me, Chantel? Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. Is anyone bored yet? It's called a genealogy. Just as a side note, for those who are doing Bible reading drills, this is not cheese on the broccoli, folks. This is equally problematic. But for some reason, the other day, as I was thinking about failure and what it does to us, this came to my mind. So I want to tell you guys some stories about these people. Remember I said, sometimes it's not even our failures, but it's the failures of our parents and our grandparents and our people who came before us. I'm going to tell you a story about Abraham, the first guy. Abraham, as far as we understand the stories, are from some of the oldest sections that we have. And the story goes, and this is the story, and I'm using the word story really particularly here. The story goes that God, in his conception, comes to him and says, I want you to kill your son for me. Is anyone wigged out by that? folks, this is not something you want to hear from anyone, never mind your sense of God or whatever that is. And so here's the most screwed up part of this story. Well, actually, no. God saying kill your son is pretty screwed up. Then Abraham basically says, okay. Your answer is, hell no, I won't kill my son. But his answer is, sure. So Abraham, the child murderer, that's what I'm going to call him. You have to understand, the child that he's supposed to kill is with his half-sister. So Abraham, can you throw it up for me? The incestuous child murderer. That's the first ancestor. Now, what you guys didn't see at the beginning of this, are these are Jesus' ancestors. These are Jesus' people. These are the people who came before Jesus. And somebody, some genius, the technical term is redactor. It means the person who put it all together. The redactor actually picked all these stories to say, these are Jesus' people. These are the people who came before Jesus. These are his ancestors. So one of Jesus' ancestors is Abraham, the incestuous child murderer. Awesome, right? Let me just remember who the second one was. Oh, yeah, Jacob. So Jacob, 2 people down from Abraham, Jacob falls in love with this woman he meets and thinks she's super swell, right? So he goes to her father and says, I would like to marry her. The potential father-in-law swindles Jacob and switches the brides at the last minute. So, you know, the wedding, he lifts up the bride and he's like, that's not who I was planning to marry. So he marries them both. As we do, right? And then what he does, he screws over his father-in-law and steals most of his flocks. So we have Abraham, the incestuous child murderer. We have Jacob, the polygamous swindler. Awesome. From there, we go to one of the most famous people in Jesus' ancestry. In fact, the one that they want everyone to know, that he is the son of David. Now, David was a king. So this is, we've kind of fast-forwarded a couple, give or take a few hundred years, depending on how you talk about these stories. David's the king of this whole nation, and he's doing pretty good. He's actually like pretty solid. Until one day, he's sitting on top of his castle or whatever he had in those days, looking out over, you know, his world, and he spies with his little eye some naked flesh. A little like that. there's a woman bathing on a rooftop down the road from him. And he's all into that. So what does he do? Now, has anyone ever thought on this story, why is she bathing on a rooftop? I personally like bathroom doors with closed doors. Could just be me, I'm not sure. But she likes to do it on the top of a roof where everyone can see her. So David's liking what he's seeing, so he sends someone out to figure out who she is. It's Bathsheba. And so David and her get together. Now, does David seduce her? Is it mutual? We're not sure in the story, but somehow they get together. They start dating. Now, here's the problem. Bathsheba is married. Not only that, Bathsheba is married to Uriah, who's currently fighting for David. So they're not even sleeping with each other behind the husband's back. He's like risking his life for David himself while David sleeps with his wife. Not awesome. Just as a leadership point, if you're a leader of someone, this is not the thing you want to learn from, right? So of course, they don't have birth control back in those days. So what happens when you sleep together? She gets pregnant. Oops. And you can see, she's pregnant and her husband hasn't been home for 3 months. That's awkward, right? So what do you think David does? David, the voyeuristic David who likes to spy at women across the rooftop bathing, what do you think he does? Do you think he comes clean? No, that's not David's style. What he does is he gets Uriah to come back from the fighting line so that he thinks, you know, he's going to come home for a break and he's going to sleep with his wife. And then we'll know that, you know, everyone will be like, oh yeah, but he was home that one time. The math kind of works out, so... But Uriah is a really solid man. He's a commander of a group of people. And he's like, if my men don't get to come home, I'm not going to come home. So he basically camps out on the city walls and he doesn't even go and see his wife. Doesn't go to see his wife, no sex, no, you know, backup to figure out whose baby this is, right? So now David's got a problem. Here he is, he's tried everything. He's knocked up Bathsheba. Uriah's not sleeping with her. What a selfish bugger he is. So here's what he does. He sends Uriah back to the front line. Now, folks, at any point, David could have come clean, right? But no, he just keeps escalating this and escalating this. He sends Uriah back. He tells the commander, I want Uriah's unit where the fighting is the heaviest. And of course, Uriah dies. Dying isn't the right word, is it? He's murdered. So one of Jesus' core ancestors, the one that everyone likes to underline, is David, the voyeuristic, adulterous murderer. Isn't this crazy? Bathsheba and David have two sons. One of them is Solomon. You guys all heard Solomon, you know, the wise guy? The story goes that in kind of this like Aladdin genie moment, God pops up and says, you get one wish. And he says, like he could ask for anything, right? Gold, fame, you know, women, whatever he wanted. And he says, I want wisdom. Not a bad answer, huh? So if ever a genie pops up in your life, this is a good answer. So remember this one today, okay? You want wisdom. So wisdom leads to all kinds of other things. He's incredibly wealthy. He builds the temple, the Jewish temple that we've all heard about. He does these incredible things. He also marries, I think it's 400 women, and he has a harem of another 400 women. Not sure what that's all about. But then in the moment that I think is probably the stupidest wise moment I've ever heard of, the wisest man in the world basically gives God the metaphoric finger. You know the genie that like he rubbed in wisdom? The thing that gave him wisdom, he's now saying, yeah, screw you. I don't want anything to do with you. Have you ever heard that story, don't bite the hand that feeds you? So we have Abraham. We have Jacob. We have David. We have Solomon, who I'm going to call the stupidest wise person I've ever heard of. When a genie gives you wisdom, you don't piss off the genie, right? That just seems standard to me. After that, we get Rehoboam, the cruel dictator, and it goes on and on and on. I could talk for hours about all these people. Now, think about Jesus in his little Jewish grade 2 class when he has to build his family tree. This is what he's throwing down in there. You want to talk about having, like, a troubled past? When we talk about our failures being, or maybe our lives being impacted, the failures of the people who've come before us, that's a pretty solid list, isn't it? My question is, why did these people make it into the Bible? Why? Let me take it one step forward. Remember, if you saw in the email, this is called the Not-So-Swedish Jesus. So Swedish Jesus, when I was growing up, I was going to age myself, we didn't have computers. We had flannel, and you drew a little picture of something, and you cut it out, and then you stuck it on the flannel. And that's how you told Bible stories. That was high-tech back in those days. Yes, I am old. That's okay. So flannel graphed Jesus in a remarkable feat of genealogy, was white with blonde hair and blue eyes. And he wore a white robe and he had a blue sash. Kind of like the picture right there. Yeah, I know he's from the Middle East and that's not at all what Middle Eastern people look like, but that's what our Jesus looked like. And his robe, his white robe, kind of represented his life. He was perfect. He was in a culture where you walked everywhere. It was dusty and dirty. They didn't have vacuum cleaners. They didn't really have baths. They didn't have any of that stuff other than Bathsheba, bathing on the roof, whatever. And Jesus' robe never got dirty. His feet never even got dirty. So we called him the Swedish Jesus because he kind of looks Swedish, doesn't he? Okay, so now let me tell you a really tough story because we've heard about Jesus' ancestors that failed. But if you're open to it, I want to tell you a story that if I was the redactor, so if I put the stories together of Jesus' life, I'm telling you, I would have left this one out. I don't know how you read it. When I read the commentaries, the guys are just doing these like mental pretzels to try and get out of this story. So I'm just going to tell you the story. Jesus, a good Jewish rabbi, is sitting with his Jewish friends one day, and a woman who isn't Jewish comes up to him. Now, the word we use for, or the Bible uses for a non-Jewish person is a Gentile. Most of us are Gentiles. And so Jesus is hanging out with his friends, and this Gentile woman comes up and says, "My daughter needs your help. She's sick, and she needs your help." And Jesus ignores her. Like, doesn't even talk to her. She keeps begging. She's like, "I need your help. Like, my daughter needs your help." And finally, as everyone's kind of getting annoyed at all the commotion she's making, Jesus turns to her and says this, "You're not Jewish. You're a Gentile. I only help Jewish people." This is not the Swedish Jesus. This does not, like this, this isn't great, is it? Now, I'm not saying you need to see the story through my lens. I'm just telling you a lens to see it through. Because the story gets worse. She keeps begging, "I need your help, I need your help." Finally, the people around Jesus are like, "Can you just deal with this?" And this is the line Jesus says to her. He says, "It isn't right to take food from children and throw it to the dogs." That is not awesome. In my growing up years, Jesus was perfect. Jesus was always loving. Race never meant anything to him. He was loving and kind and supportive, and he didn't care. He just cared about people. And then I read that, and I go, I don't even know what to do with that. But let me suggest a way forward. What if the redactor who put all the stories to Jesus together, and that's what they did. We know there's stories from all over the place. The redactor picked the stories and put those stories together. What if The redactor put this story in the Bible for the same reason he put the stories of all of Jesus' ancestors, to say this: yes, we have all failed. Because if I'm honest, when I look at that, my interpretation of that is, it wasn't Jesus' best moment. I wouldn't even say it was a good moment. I'd say it was a brutal moment. And yet, Jesus' life still has impacted us 2,000 years later. Remember I started my message by saying, what does your failure make you think about you? What if these stories are in the text for the very reason to say, what if your failure doesn't make you worthless? Jesus had brutal ancestors. The list is just ridiculous. He wasn't perfect all the time. I don't know, unless you can find another way to read that story. He had moments that weren't great. And yet, he still had value and influence and impact that's lasted thousands of years. What if we see our failures as just that? I failed. I failed at my relationship, failed at my job, failed at school. But what if we still have worth regardless of our failures? Isn't that a beautiful way to see these stories? Regardless of what you've done, regardless of what you screwed up, regardless of the stupid decisions you made, regardless of all that crap, you're still worthy. You're still valuable. Just let that sit in your heart for a second. In traditional Christianity, we would have said it this way: God still loves you, regardless of your failure. Okay. This message is going to be in kind of two chunks. That's my first chunk. That feels kind of nice, doesn't it? A sense of, yeah, you know what? I have screwed up some stuff. Screwed up lots of stuff. But I'm still in the game. I'm still valuable. I'm still worthy. I have something to offer. But then something started to mess up my brain. This is the part that just completely blew my mind. Because if my failures doesn't make me worthless, then your failures, and sorry, let me say it this way, if my failures don't make me worthless, and your failures don't make you worthless, then the people in my life who failed, and maybe even failed me, maybe they're not worthless to me either. And before you just kind of let me give you this little logic train to like sprinkle these little things a little, just let me throw this out. Because what I'm suggesting here is completely against our culture right now. If my failures don't make me worthless and your failures don't make you worthless, then the person on social media who said the wrong thing or used the wrong words, words that we consider failures, the person in our lives who behaves in a way that we think is a failure, the person that we see on TV who believes a certain thing about the world or on how the world should work or on how we should use the world that we see as a failure, all those failures don't make them worthless to us. We seem to live in a culture right now that says, if you failed and if I can find one failure in your life, I completely discount you completely. But if the Jesus story is ringing your bell the way it's ringing mine, it says our failures don't make us worthless. And the failures of the people in our lives, what if it doesn't make them worthless to us? What if I still have things to learn from people who do things that I think are failures, that I think are abhorrent, that I think are completely against how we should all live? What if we see them as valuable too? In a world where one wrong social media comment can get you ostracized from a group, that's countercultural, isn't it? And to me, that's the spiritual message here. Yeah, it's all good that I feel good about myself, that my failures aren't going to take me out. That feels good. But man, you want to get kicked in the head a little bit? Try flipping that around and looking at the person in your life, in your world, in the larger world, who's failed in whatever way and saying, no, no, I still have something to learn from you. You still have value in my life. Folks, I think if we can get over this connection between failure and worthlessness in our own lives, we will have the power to change our world. The amount of time we spend living in that negative thought, I did this wrong, therefore I suck. I failed here, therefore I can never have. I did this wrong once, so I'll never be able to do it right again. The amount of mental effort and physical effort it takes to live in there, we could have solved world peace by now. If we didn't have that in our world, folks, like think about all the energy that goes into that mental process. And if we could let that go, if we could let go of that connection between failure and worth, and then if we can switch that around and look at the people in our lives who do stuff that we do not like all the time and say, just because you did that wrong does not mean you have no value to me. That's loving your neighbor, I think. If you have any thoughts about this message, disagreements, comments, send me an email, vince@friendchurch.com. I'd love to hear from you guys. Have a great week. Next week, we're going to do the Enneagram. If you want to know kind of what your inner mind is doing poorly, come and check it out. It'll be great. And we'll see you guys after the service. Have a great week.